From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 369, SQL Question and Answer Panel at SQL Intersection Orlando 2014, with guests Kim Tripp, Brent Ozar, and Paul Randall. Recorded Wednesday, April 16th, 2014. Run As Radio is produced each week by PWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. I'm here at SQL Intersections in Orlando, alongside SharePoint Intersection, Azure Intersection, and all the dev intersections. And we're doing the SQL Q&A in front of a live audience. And we do definitely have the usual suspects for our Q&A panel, beginning with the beautiful one, Ms. Kim Tripp.
Brent Ozar.
Say hi, Kim.
Hi, Kim.
Nice. And Brent Ozar is here.
The ugly one. I get it.
I wasn't going to go there, man. You've got the beard. You can relate. It's all good. That's it. He's the cute one. It's Paul Randall. Where do you guys want to start? We've already done a show specifically on 2014. And we had such a great opportunity with all these amazing folks from Microsoft, Joss and Mike and Shep.
Yep.
And Evgeny, whose name I mispronounced almost every time.
I think you're not alone in that one, actually. I'm working on it.
I think it's one of the best parts of having a conference like this, where we get a chance to bring in folks who help build the product.
Yeah.
And we can really drill into what the thinking was and where we're going to go here. But now this is more for our attendees. What have
we
answered?
We've got a list. They can go from anything on that list or 2014 if they want.
Yes, so we have a slide.
I know you guys have questions because nobody's left me alone for three straight days. So come on.
Oh, okay,
I want to hear. Well, no,
right.
I didn't. That's on tape now. Thank you.
Nice. So yeah, we have, I don't know, this must be one of your slides, Paul, because there's 40 bullet points on that. That's a lot of bullet points.
Any
of
questions?
Areas we could talk to.
Because we can talk all day about random things if you want. Yeah. But
yes, in the back.
So, should we start with virtualization from the back of the room?
Because
all SQL
one,
servers
Brent.
Should be virtualized, right, Brent?
Well, I'm to the point now where it's like it's a default for databases under 100 gigs or servers with less than 100 gigs worth of data. It just makes sense. It's somewhat of an easy button for high availability and disaster recovery because we're all just trying to get asked to manage more servers. It's easier to make perform than it's ever been before. But then it starts to get a little sketchy beyond that. Will it work with multi-terabyte databases? Sure, but you want to start by crawling and then gradually learning to run.
And that's my question is, why 100 gigs? What's magic about that number?
So it seems like it's easiest to make the database scale if you can cache more of it in RAM. Memory hides all kinds of sins. But you don't want to put more than 100 gigs worth of data, more than 100 gigs worth of RAM in a VM. It starts to make less.
Do you have any idea how much fun it is to put together a purchase order for a terabyte of RAM?
I have one client who has a standing order with HP. Every time they bring out a new server, they want it absolutely maxed out full of RAM. And
nice.
It's just so cool to see 3 terabytes worth of RAM.
Of RAM.
Playing around on their
RAM.
I have a customer that's an online gambling customer, and, you know, they don't care about money. So
one terabyte. They care about it a lot. That's why they have so much of it.
That's true.
Yeah, you'd think we'd learn from that, but, you know.
Yeah, lots and lots of idea. The correct answer for how much RAM for SQL Server is more.
Yes.
All right. But
I could argue that you don't want to use it inefficiently either, right, guys? So, I mean, you still want to do performance tuning. Mm-hmm. You can kill problems with hardware. Mm-hmm. You know, more memory does cover a lot of sins. I'm with you with that. But you still want to be smarter about your database design, your index structures. You want to clean up your fragmentation so your table's not all bloated in the cache. You want to make sure your stats are up to date. There's so many things that people aren't doing that, to me, become even more critical in a virtualized environment.
Oh, yes.
Because when those things aren't done, you get to see those problems more quickly and more easily. And I would also say there's a lot of configuration that you need to be really on top of, depending on what you're going to use from a virtualization perspective. So, and I'm not the expert in that area. Just these are the things that I know from having done some of that. So
I guess that's part of this. If I'm going to create a VM for SQL Server, what does the storage architecture of my data look like in that VM? Is this effectively like it's on a hard drive? It's just one volume?
So usually the reason that you go virtualization is to save money on hardware administration, time, all that kind of thing. And so that means you don't carve out 4 terabyte drives for this server, 6 drives for that server. Mm-hmm. You make one big pool of drives and let the system do as best as it can with that.
Right.
When you want to start tuning it as hard as you can go, then you start playing around with fixed numbers of drives or, you know, going even towards physical boxes. But I don't want to try and micromanage hardware when my whole goal is to save money, not to wring performance out. Nobody ever said, if I could just virtualize this, it'd be amazingly fast. No, that's not exactly how this works.
So yeah, if you're actually trying to squeeze every ounce of performance out, you're not talking about virtualization. You're talking about something else. Yeah. It's about maintainability, simplicity, reliability for a reasonable cost.
Do more with less, blah, blah, blah.
Great. Question here?
Oh, that was
clustering versus availability groups or in addition to availability groups for uptime.
That's also probably Brent.
Yeah, I started answering.
All right. I'm just going to hang out back here. Yes. Maybe go hang out with my husband.
So the question was failover clustering versus always on availability groups. With failover clustering, you only have to have one copy of the data because you're using shared storage. So as you start to talk about multi-terabyte databases, failover clustering is just more of a no-brainer. Always on availability groups, you can have multiple servers with, say, local solid state storage, which can be cheaper on the hardware side, but it's more moving parts. It's a more complex piece of technology. Generally speaking, I don't like always on availability groups unless you have 2 to 3 full-time database administrators. I know people who can do it with less. It just gets a little bit on the risky side. Failover clustering is much easier to do with less people.
Isn't always on a big part of this is you're working with your network guys because it's a non-trivial chunk of data you're moving around.
Oh man, your Windows guys, your Windows guys, your network guys, your hardware guys, all of this, you have to read RSS feeds of every patch that comes out. I mean, there's a lot of gotchas there.
Okay.
That's very complex.
Clustering is my friend. Do you have a preference for how you connect 2 servers onto 1 data store? Are you still believing in iSCSI, Mr. Ozar?
I am. I'm a huge fan of 10 gig iSCSI. It's just like an easy button for things like failover clustering. It just makes backups easier, makes heartbeat network stuff easier. Just throw that in.
You're making fiber channel people sad.
I like fiber channel too. They both suck in their own unique ways. Yes.
All right. Another question.
Yeah. So going back to the virtualization question, I wanted to ask if, modern hypervisor vendors have found any clever ways to handle the 4 Newman node access caused by the physical abstraction, which is my understanding is a big issue with virtualizing database.
Yes. So starting with VMware 5.5, if I remember right, they pass through the NUMA stuff out into the guest so they can actually see the NUMA architecture as it is. Your best bet with this, though, is to have all of your hosts be identical hardware.
Yeah.
Same number of cores.
That's a blast of the past, isn't it? Remember when clustering required identical hardware?
Yes.
So, because NUMA architecture is not new. It's been around a while, but it's always been abstracted, and
you lose
some advantage.
Yeah. So then in order to license SQL Server, usually you build a separate pool of VMware hosts anyway. You license those with Enterprise Edition, and at that point, they're all the same hardware anyway, so it's much easier to pull that off. So the key is to know to look for VMware 5.5 or higher.
It's just VMware that's made NUMA transparent? I have not looked at this.
I haven't looked at the latest Hyper 2012 R2, so it may also pass it through as well. I know 2012 did not.
Yeah, if you really want to get into a weird conversation, you get a couple of serious memory hardware geeks together, and we'll have a lot of fun talking about cycle timings on memory transfer.
You guys can be in another room. Yes.
Deep down, you know, I'm a hardware guy. Right? Yeah. That's where I come from. So, yeah, if you want to talk about NUMA, oh, I'm excited. Sir, question.
Sticking with the virtualization and the high availability theme there, we have several our bigger SQL servers have been requested to, or I'm trying to think, instead of using SRM through VMware, I haven't heard anybody really ever mention double take full server replication.
Yeah.
Any thoughts?
So double take isn't the only one. There's a lot of filter drivers that sit in between SQL Server and its storage, and they send the writes off somewhere else. They've been around for a long time. That's cool. I just generally want to do that at the hypervisor layer, just have no drivers going on inside the guest whatsoever. As long as I'm going on virtualization, I'd rather let the hypervisor do it because the hypervisor can also load balance storage. The latest versions of VMware, for example, and Hyper-V does the same kind of thing manually. You can say, I have these five SANs, keep load balance between all of them, and it'll do it automatically. Whereas we can't do that with things like DoubleTick.
And let us make sure before we get out of this day, we don't have a good argument about SANs. Another comment here?
Well, about virtualization. No, sorry.
Yeah.
Database consistency checker. I was curious about on SQL Server 2014 with in-memory databases, and they've got to have their hardened storage and all that fun stuff, durable storage. What's the impact in DBCC checks and all that stuff?
So DBCC check DB does in fact not check memory optimized tables. So at the moment we don't have any checks for consistency in memory. We do check some automatically the data files, the checkpoint files, and also you can force a database with checksum checks. So there are ways to verify physical consistency of the data files.
So you left, and now they've let this happen. What? How? What? How? You've got to go back. You have to go back.
Yeah.
Unless you were involved in that.
Josh,
I guess that
would be my question then. Is this just because it's really version one, and you're going to add more features over time? We'll see it in service packs and things, or you think you've got consistency checking where it needs to be for in-memory database?
No, we continue looking at this. We know it's a bit limited right now. We would like to add more. Yes. So it is indeed V1 scoping, but you also need to think about consistency checking for memory optimized tables. It's going to be somewhat different than for disk based tables due to the different data structures, different index structures and everything.
Yeah. I got to think getting it out in the field for a while and seeing how people actually use it and what issues may occur will help you build better tools anyway.
Absolutely, absolutely. That is also why we wanted to release this in 2014 and not in 2020 when we build all the features that everyone wants.
Because you'll be wrong. So sooner is always better for getting things accurate. I mean, 1 second here. Mike?
Yeah, I was going to add on the DBCC. As you said, all the checkpoint files are checksum. That's not optional. The system does it. It enforces it. It checks them during backup. And the other thing to remember is what's in memory does not match what's on disk. What's on disk is just streams of rows. There's very simple formats. There are no allocation maps and allocation tables. There are no indexes. So the data structure is incredibly simple on disk.
But it's also regenerable too, right? If I take what's on disk, I should be able to reproduce what's in memory?
Yes, but it's a logical reproduction of what's in memory, not physically the same.
Okay, I get that. That's cool. And it's good. It's a good point. Yeah, and also new features. Sir.
When would you voluntarily use a heap over a clustered index?
Okay. Oh, you just pushed Kim's button right there. That's just jamming on the button.
Okay.
There we go. We can all go. Heap versus clustered.
Okay, heap versus clustered is a great debate. And I'll start by saying that there are uses for heaps. I'm not against using a heap. A heap tends to be a great choice for high-performance data loading. It's often the structure that I will use if I want to do parallelized load into that heap structure. Then sometimes, and I had a customer that was loading into a clustered table with non-clusters and then having to do data cleansing and so forth. And I actually instead loaded into the heap, created a cluster, did the data cleansing, then dropped that clustered, created the production clustered on the final amount of data with its non-clusters, and I brought their 72-hour process down to 6 by basically rearranging the order in which the indexes were created and kind of optimizing that whole overall process. So the long story short is heaps... Their biggest claim to fame is high-performance data loading. Now, if you don't have any non-clusters, if you're going to just store like clickstream data, and you're going to store data that you're not really using for a day-to-day application for singleton inserts, updates, and deletes, a heap can also be a usable structure in the database. But often when I hear about clickstream data, people then start doing post-processing on that, where we have our clicks, but then we store a table that is not individual clicks, but the number of clicks per hour, per day, per week, whatever. Well, then you're aggregating data by time, right? So often, I probably wouldn't have a heap there. I'd have a clustered index by date, but it might be my only index so that I can do more optimized aggregations. So in production environments, when you want to do things like aggregations or you want to do further work, I often find that clustered tables can outperform, not outperform heaps, but there's a lot of factors to that. But at the kind of low to middle to fairly close to the high end, good clustered indexes tend to outperform almost everything else. And when I say a good clustered, I usually mean one that's unique, one that's narrow, one that's static, one that's ever increasing, one that is non-nullable, and one that's fixed width.
Identity columns.
So something like identity is good, but it's not the only choice. In large VLTs, I often choose a date ID combination to have that ever increasing pattern. Because then I get a secondary benefit of being able to do range-based scans with something that's not fragmented. So there's a lot of factors to it. I'll try to keep it short and simple. Heaps are not the devil, right? But they're not really ideal for every scenario. Clustered tables aren't, you know, great for every scenario. But a good, well-chosen clustered table is good for most production environments. And heaps tend to be great for high-performance data loading and especially parallelized load. There's a really good white paper called the Data Loading Performance Guide. So if any of you guys are doing high-performance data loading, you should definitely check that out.
What's high performance mean? Size or time?
High performance data loading is usually time because of size.
Right.
So, you know, you've got just a massive load of massive amounts of data, and that's usually gigabytes, if not possibly even terabytes of data. Like that 72-hour thing, I don't remember the exact size, but they were studying, it was banking information for terrorist trends. And every time the government came up with new regulations, they'd have to reanalyze all of the banking data that they had. So long story short, there is a place for heaps. It's just usually for me, high performance data loading. Okay.
All right.
See? I did that in like less than the rest of the hour. I know. You guys are playing.
All right. Next question.
So I have a failover cluster and I have transactional replication for a replicated server for reporting services.
Yeah.
So what's the next step for scaling out?
Oh, the next step for scaling out, reads or writes? Reads. So how much hardware are we talking about here? Like, have you tried scaling up each individual box involved first? Like, whatever box you're doing the transactional replication to, does it have enough RAM to cache the database in memory or?
Yeah, it's fully in memory.
So if it's fully in memory and it still can't keep up, what's the weight that you see on that replicated box? Don't know. All right, good. I would look and see what the weights are like on that box, because it may be time for index tuning then, if you're doing replication.
Yeah, see, I was going to say, depending on what your scaling problems are on that secondary server, there's a lot of things I would look at. Like, one of my favorite things to do, not on the publisher, but on the subscriber, mm-hmm. is read committed snapshot isolation, mm-hmm. because then your queries don't block replication, and replication isn't blocked by your queries. So you can actually significantly improve sometimes some of the blocking problems that you get from replication on the subscriber. So it's great because you're not necessarily putting any of that versioning overhead on the publisher, but you've got it on the subscriber. So like, there's a lot of things I would look at before I would necessarily go scalable shared databases or look at another alternative. You know, there are options, but I would really try to make sure that you've scaled up that subscriber as far as you can go with possible, because the whole benefit of replication, right, is you can have different indexes, different maintenance strategies, different statistics, different isolation. So there's so many things you can do to probably scale that up that I would absolutely look there before I'd start throwing more, I mean, maybe throw more hardware at it, but after that or with that, tune it so that you get the best out of it.
I want to make sure that you can't solve it with indexes, because as you add more servers, management sucks. You know, now you're dealing with more boxes, you have to maintain more missing or more broken parts. There's the fallacy that the more engines you put on a plane, the more reliable it is. No, not at all. You have more problems that you run into. So if you could get past it with just the one existing replication box, I'd much rather do that angle.
Yeah. So read committed snapshot isolation. It's there's two levels of versioning that are possible, and it is incorrectly documented and detailed everywhere online where they say that both database options are necessary to leverage versioning. One's called read committed snapshot and the other one's called allow snapshot isolation. Read committed snapshot is actually the same as Oracle has essentially by default, and it gets rid of all anomalies. No, in 10G and higher, you've got the same level of isolation in terms of reads as Oracle does, in the sense that you run a query and you will get what we call point-in-time consistency to the point-in-time when the statement started. So that's read-committed snapshots. And that is the more common of options used. And that turns on versioning. And the cool thing about it is you turn it on. There's absolutely nothing else you have to do for read-committed-based queries. But you do have to potentially change things if you need locking. There's a lock-in called read-committed lock. But read committed snapshot is great, especially for things like subscribers. I'm a big fan of it there. I'm a big fan of read committed snapshot to begin with. Okay. It's really snapshot isolation and versioning is not just about, reducing blocking or deadlocks. It's about accuracy of your queries as well. And there's anomalies that are potentially there in read committed that get resolved when you are using versioning. So this could be a whole discussion. I actually wrote a 60-page white paper on versioning. I compared the first 10 pages are comparing to 10G. So there's a whole bunch, because at the time that was what existed when I wrote the white paper. So there is a white paper on this, and I'm happy to take more of this offline if you want to chat. But I'm a big fan of RCSI. A lot of us call it RCSI, but technically it's called, God, what is it technically called? No, read committed using row level versioning. Something like that. It's got a really long, ugly name that no one remembers.
I like it when the SQL Server team guys look at
it. None of us can remember it. We all kind of go, yeah, read committed row level version.
They got a lot of acronyms.
But most of us just call us RCSI, but the database option is literally read underscore committed underscore snapshot. So you'll find it with that for sure.
And just to echo what Kim said, you can also use memory optimized tables as a subscriber. They naturally have the multi-versioning and the snapshot isolation.
Yeah, okay.
And it's a nice way to use it. You can definitely use them in a subscriber. They can't be a publisher, but they can be a subscriber. It echoes also what you said about different indexes. You can make a different choice of indexes, a different type, you know, even table.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can do partitioned replication. You're not getting all the data, all the rows, different table structure, different index structures. That's one of the huge benefits to replication.
So. How big is a database?
Yeah.
About how many? 90 gigs?
Oh, 90
yeah.
gigs.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, don't scale out to more hardware.
Get more memory.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, fix your indexes. Yeah.
Fix your indexes, get more memory. Make it optimal in that environment. You don't need to scale out yet. I mean, I don't feel like you're anywhere near it yet.
Not saying you're small.
No.
You're saying?
Not saying it's not critical, okay?
Another question back here.
This is a virtualization IO subsystem question.
Yeah.
So
Brent Q&A.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You're hitting all his hot buttons.
Quite a while back, Jimmy May did this whole thing on, right, the alignment and the allocation unit size and the stripe width and blah, blah, blah. So when you virtualize a SQL server, and especially if that's hitting sort of SAN storage and you're having the argument with your SAN team, the whole stripe conversation, and it's not even NTFS anymore and all that, that's just out the window. But the part that I feel like I still have control of is the file allocation unit size. Is it mm-hmm. still important in a virtual environment to get the MDF and LDF off of the boot partition so you don't have a 4K block size, or is that just like busy work?
Oh, it's such an interesting question, and it depends. There's two parts into there. One is, do you need to get the databases off the boot drive? That answer is unequivocally yes, because I'm more worried about someone filling up the C drive by downloading Windows patches, putting things on their desktop, etc., or an out-of-control database growing and filling up the C drive. So that I kind of want off the C drive anyway. The second question is, where I put the databases, what should the NTFS allocation unit size be? And it depends on the version, make and model of SAN that you have. For example, with NetApp, it stores everything in 4K chunks internally anyway, so there's no real performance benefit. Some of the new solid-state vendors take the same approach. EMC, on the other hand, still recommends that you use 64K NTFS allocation unit size. So check with your VMware guys about what, or Hyper-V guys, what storage is underneath it, and that'll drive what determines it. It's job security is the other way I like to look at that. Richard's taking a question from Twitter. No. We got another one back there. There we go.
pros and cons of data compression versus index compression, or using both in the same?
How big is a database?
Let's say 100 gig.
Say 100 gigs. That's enterprise edition to begin with. And so that implies that you're spending a lot on the licensing because you can't do it for less than like $50,000 US. At that point, don't put $1,000 worth of memory in the server. Go get enough memory that you can cache that 100 gig database in RAM. I know I keep banging that drum over and over again, but we're talking about 50 grand worth of licensing. Don't run it on a laptop. Right? This is, don't go to the extent of changing your schema to fix a $500 memory problem.
Well, and I was also going to say that just because you compress, it's not a magic bullet for great performance gains. And this is a great slide that I always love to reference because it came from some of the early adopters that were using compression, and they found in some cases phenomenal compression. Some got gains, some didn't. I mean, like look at the customer 6, 81% compression and only a 3% performance gain, whereas customer number 4 got an 80% compression savings, but they actually suffered by 11% performance hit. But they actually still chose to go with compression because their savings in terms of hardware and resources, because these were multi-terabyte sized environments, was worth it to them. And, you know, so depending on the size of the data, and when you start talking about multi-terabytes, then it starts to become much harder to handle with hardware. But when you're looking at double digits or even triple digit gigabytes, you can do so much with hardware these days that's fairly inexpensive, relatively speaking. I would do that. I would look at indexes. I would try to do as much as I can with the database. And I personally, I'm a big fan of kind of trying to optimize the structures before I use compression, because you might pay Peter to pay, you know, to pay Paul, right? You might be causing one problem and solving one. So I kind of like efficient structures first, and, you know, and then I kind of look at compression from there. But
got a question right here in the middle.
So we have a SAS system, and the server it's on slows down quite a bit when they run their queries, because for some reason we let our analytical services group do their own queries. And
I'm sorry.
Is there a way to, can I still do the performance tuning, et cetera? Because their queries are different. They're not SQL queries. They've got a whole bunch of different text and stuff that they can do in there, and I'm not familiar with it. But can it still be able to be tuned like with weight stats and doing and looking at indexes and stuff? Is it similar enough to SQL, even because it's running on SQL, that it, that can be done? This is SAS.
And now
analysis services.
Wait, no, SAS is analytic software that's querying SQL Server.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's
different. Okay.
Man, there's a lot of overloaded.
The computer industry is incredibly clever in its reuse of terms. At the pain of everybody else. But yes, I mean, all of the things that you're going to do to tune SQL Server, since it is running on a SQL Server and doing more relational data warehousing rather than SSAS, you can do. And one of the best things to do would be to start with things like weights and queues and start there and see where SQL Server is waiting the most. But you can still do index tuning and cleanup and consolidation and fragmentation.
Good point. Because yeah, it depends on what the support
is. Well, okay. Good point.
The application vendor might say, change anything in this database, you're not supported. Which to me is a completely BS way of having to support you, but many, many vendors do have that. One of the things you might do in that case is do all your tuning, mess around with all your indexes, and anytime that you're going to get them in to look at something, put it all back.
A lot of people will have basically the create and drop kind of script, so that when you call in for support, you've gotten rid of the things that you've tweaked and tuned, put it back to the state. And you almost always have to do that for the products that support changes. So that their scripts can run, yeah.
Well, hold on. Is SAS querying your databases, or is this a SAS-owned repository?
Their design.
Right, it's yours. Okay, so here's the screwy part. You can't tune indexes. Indexes won't matter because those bozos running SAS queries will change them continuously depending on the questions they want to ask the data.
Sure.
This is the classic pattern for the fast track data warehouse reference architecture. So Microsoft lays out this plan for when you can't index it because queries will come in every which way but loose and they'll keep changing every time. You won't have enough RAM to cache the data, and you have to maximize throughput. When you look at weight stats, it's going to show storage as the bottleneck, and you got to tune storage.
Yes, but they might also be able to leverage some of the things like column store indexes potentially if it's not read-write, if it's read-only, because there is no key order. I mean, one of my favorite things about column store is the simplicity of the creation of it. There's no column order. You don't have a key. You don't have include. How many column store indexes can you have in 2012? One, right? So it and the reason why is that it's individual stores of columns. And the beauty of it right now is it doesn't matter what the queries are. They just have to grab from the columns that are being requested. And there's a lot of clever things they can do to optimize that. I mean, incredibly optimize that. That's definitely Mike's baby here. So there might be some indexing that you might be able to add that might be easy enough to add that it could support a myriad of different types of workloads if it's a lot of large-scale aggregations, data warehousing types of queries. I mean, ding, 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 column store. But right now in 2012, if you put that column store index on, it's read-only. So if this is a read-write environment, then you're going to have to look at 2014 if they support it and so forth.
Read-only 2005.
So fast track, you're going to need to look at optimizing the storage. And there's never been a better time to look for jobs for a SQL Server. It's a great market. Yeah.
If you can't change your company, change your company.
Yep.
All right, we had a question right here.
Yeah, I was just going to say resource governor might play a little bit into that too.
Not on 2005 though.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah. I think we'd probably start with the 2005 problem and work from there. Wow. That's a very early version. Question back here.
Richard's getting his exercise before he leaves for Nepal.
Is there any reason to change your TempDB strategy for 2014?
Yes, there is. And Kendra just, she's shaking her head. So Kendra, my co-founder back there, just wrote a blog post about it. It hasn't gone live yet, has it? So do you want to talk through it? I go ahead. Oh, don't you just love it how people do it? Oh, dang,
wander towards
way to delegate,
anyway.
Kendra.
We'll see if I read it. Yes. So thanks to the wonderful SQL Server team. Man, there's so many cool things in 2014 that make such a huge difference. They push data through to the data files less frequently. They don't flush data out to disk as often. Your need for write speed in TempDB plummets in 2014. It's fantastic. It's there's so many good, interesting improvements in 2014 that haven't gotten a lot of press yet, and that's one of them.
Is this the delayed commit you're talking about?
No, this is just plain old housekeeping in TempDB. Do either of you guys have anything to do with this? So basically, it just means that SQL Server will keep stuff in RAM as long as it possibly can and not write it out to disk if it doesn't need to. So in Kendra's testing, I want to say that on 2012, we saw 600 megs worth of, if I'm right, 600 megs worth of writes into TempDB on 2012, near zero for 2014.
Kendra is actually vibrating back here. So clearly you're misquoting her. I'll just pass the microphone over.
No, he did a very good job. Yeah, on every single TempDB file in the test, we had 600 megs of writes flowing through on 2012, and it just magically disappeared on the same workload on 2014.
Magically.
Well, I've got one thing that it could be without knowing anything about this workload. If the cardinality estimations for some of the queries were improved, there might be spills or different algorithms, maybe less hash aggregations and hash joins occurring. I don't know. And that could be putting a lot less pressure on TempDB, which would drastically reduce the cost and so forth.
Oh, yeah. It was a super simple workload. No parallelism. One query basically beating up TempDB, selecting into a temp table. Yeah. Same plan.
Oh, but select into had some improvements. Do you guys... Yeah, there's some improvements around select into that I don't know all the details off the top of my head. And I think Shep knows that one really well. So.
That wouldn't explain it. The post Bob Dorr has a post that he put on the CSS site about this improvement with the lessening of the eager writing into this, and it's just specifically TempDB, of course. So he has that on the CSS site about this also. It also works if you put sort in TempDB equals on for index builds.
Oh, the sort in TempDB stuff. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. So getting back to the original question. How are we going to be changing our TempDB strategies in 2014?
Well, I still would absolutely say that the things that we've done in the past to optimize TempDB are not going away, but your use of TempDB might be changing such that your impact and need for a larger, more scalable TempDB might be reduced. But you're still going to want I can't imagine why you wouldn't want multiple files that are optimized, the things that we've generally done.
This doesn't help the whole TempDB contention case.
No.
And
what are you doing on my Amazon here?
If you've got Prime, I'm gonna check out.
I do have Prime.
In the year 2014, if you are building a brand new SQL server and you're not using solid state drives for TempDB, do not pass Go. Do not collect $200. Stop going to conferences in Orlando and blowing the company's money that you should be spending on
$450 for a 1 terabyte SSD.
I know, it's crazy.
It's
isn't
hard
it?
To argue with
it's
that.
It's a beautiful thing there.
Yeah, 50 cents. A gig.
Yeah.
That's what we're at with SSD now.
And you can have it within the next 3 hours and 6 minutes. You can have it tomorrow.
Yeah, they don't know I'm in Florida, though, so that's the problem.
Quick question about what he just showed, the TempDB, or the solid state. Are those, we've had a couple of them, and the laptops have just failed. Are there specific ones for servers, or would something like that actually be a high availability, you know, keep going?
I know. Isn't it crazy that all these time we had hard drives before solid states? Those things never broke. They were bulletproof, right? Never died ever, lasted for centuries. No, so all drives are going to fail, regardless of whether you're getting consumer or enterprise drives. This always gets tricky because I always wonder if there's a sponsor or somebody like this in the audience. But you can either pay 5 times as much for like enterprise grade drives and get a warranty, or pay 5 times less and get faster drives, but you have to replace them when they die. Guess how many spares you can buy and put on the shelf if you spend 5 times less.
And build your system so they can tolerate failure. I have found that most of the SSD vendors are not doing smart well. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't spent time, where the spinning hard drive vendors have done a good job of communicating smart, like they figured it out a long time ago and they're not messing with it. And so all of our controllers read the drive well, will give you warnings when they're supposed to and so forth. But I can't tell you how many times I've had gone back to a failed SSD and looked at the smart value and said, oh yeah, this has been complaining for ages, and the controller didn't pick it up because it's not set correctly. So, and it's stuff we haven't had to think about for years, and they're still doing it wrong.
No, agreed. And the other thing I'll also say is that not every solid state drive is created equally. And you definitely want to, especially for hardware, like I've been running an OCZ Vertex 512 gig. Yeah, I guess that doesn't show up on the radio. I've been running an OCZ Vertex 512 gig solid state drive. I've actually got two of those and a mini solid state. So I've got 1.2 terabytes of solid state drives in this laptop here. And I've been running this now for 14, 16 months. Now I do regular backups. I check things, but you know, I'm really jinxing myself by saying this, but I so far have,
this
I'm
machine
screwed.
Is not
it's
making
gonna
it
fail
home.
Tonight.
No
Get
way.
Out my backup drive right now. But you know, the long story short is I have had drives fail in the past, and some drives failed sooner than others. And especially when it's commodity hardware and you're buying it for laptops and smaller low end types of things, you want to be careful, read the reviews, and you might have to try things out, but just stick to your guns with things like backups and make sure you're keeping track of things. So. Well,
but you do it in
server,
mirrored pairs.
Yeah.
I mean, you do it in a RAID array. For about the reviews where you go, my personal favorite is if you search for Tom's Hardware SSD hierarchy, scroll down the page, and they group them into tiers. So tier one drives all perform the same. Tier two drives all perform
the same. Yeah, and Tom's does a lot of heavy lifting for you. These guys test a lot of drives, and they're right up to date. New drive drops, it shows up in the hierarchy table pretty quick.
One of the things that I see people doing wrong with SSDs is using one. Mm-hmm. And doing RAID 0. Thou shalt never use RAID 0 with SQL Server.
And they put it in the wrong place.
We'll talk about that in a second. So if you're going to use an SSD, you've got to use at least two and RAID 1 across it. And people say, it's just 10 dB. It doesn't matter. What happens if your 10 dB is unavailable? Your
SQL server instantly shuts down.
Yeah.
That's not very available.
Ends quickly.
Oh, but just one other thing. Make sure you put them in the right place. A lot of people say, oh, you should always put your log drives on solid state. And to be honest, that's not usually where everybody's doing a lot of random IOs. And it might be a lot better off for your data portion. But then from a virtualization perspective, if you have 15 databases that are all going to the L drive for the log, then solid state is better for the log than it would be for data. But you want to think through where your random patterns are. And spend your money wisely.
What's your biggest IO bottleneck?
Mm-hmm.
That's going to benefit from using an SSD.
So I was just going to say in response to that question, the Intel S3700 line is a really great intersection of performance, cost, and warranty, mm-hmm. and is what Glenn Berry actually recommends people look at for a non-enterprise cost, but enterprise-level performance and warranty for SSDs.
Yeah, and you know, a great plug just to add to that is Glenn, one of the guys on our team. He does a lot of hardware analysis. Like, I don't know when he sleeps. He's like analyzing each new vendor and hardware, and he does all sorts of blog posts and write-ups, and he wrote a book on SQL Server hardware, and so forth. But yeah, lots of good stuff out there. So I guess the point is look around for that before you go and buy new hardware. In fact, we don't buy any new hardware without talking to Glenn. And it's really a good idea to consider some of that. Oh, and well, okay, sorry. Shameless plug, but Brent did it, so I guess we shouldn't feel guilty about it.
Our DBA team is switching our backup strategy to a Microsoft Data Protection Manager.
I'm actually turning my mic off. I'm not going to answer that one.
Are there lessons learned or things we should be afraid of?
If you search for Brent Ozar DPM review, I wrote a review of it almost 10 years ago now, but all the same stuff still holds true. They call it constant data protection, but it only runs every so many minutes. Yeah. That's not constant data protection. You can do better with simple transaction log shipping. You can easily run the server out of space. Each individual SQL server hones in on one DPM backup server. If that DPM backup server is down, your backups stop working. There's a litany of things you need to know going in. If you know the limitations, it's pretty cool. But you gotta know those limitations. It's challenging. I would say too, I'd feel that way about any backup software.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you don't have to learn it. You've done a restore.
Is there something about the Microsoft main that just makes us automatically think, well, now it's just gonna work?
Like they put the CD
in
and it's just gonna go.
To.
It's just gonna happen. Yeah. Did you turn your microphone on? Kim? Is your mic, did you turn
your mic? No, my mic's back on.
She's waiting for a legit question.
Let's take another question then.
Thanks. So, just going back to the question of, you know, having separate RAID array for TempDB, I'm just adding up the number of drives we're talking about. So if we were talking about having a mirrored RAID for the C drive, right, mirrored RAID for TempDB, and then I read that the buffer pool is supposed to have its own, or it's suggested, right? So that would be a third pair, and then the database itself would be a fourth pair. So am I not?
Yeah, we get special checks every month from hardware vendors.
But so,
no, I wish we did. Believe me.
What you're doing with RAID, and specifically using something like RAID 1 or maybe even just RAID 5, is you're using the redundancy that's built into RAID so that if you have a drive failure, it doesn't take anything.
But I think what he's really asking is if he's got 10 terabytes of data, and now we've got to have that rated, at least RAID 1, preferably. I'm a RAID 10 fan. So we start doubling that, and I'm a RAID 10 triple mirroring fan, which now means triple mirroring and three times that. So now we start looking at 30 terabytes, and oh wait, how big is our TempDB?
So
and right, that needs to be rated. Sure, but it's still not.
Somebody's professional setting up that level of storage.
Absolutely, but it's still expensive, and that's
you're
where.
Looking at that amount of data, you're looking at expensive.
You're preaching to the choir, my dear. But you're right. It is expensive, and you have to.
Well, it's not just that, but so if we're talking about, like, say, I'm a fan of building custom boxes, you know, rather than going out and having that done to get somebody to put the custom package together for me. But then there's a limit, or else you have to go to a bigger form factor to fit in. What are we talking about? You know, 8 or 10 physical drives per server?
So this is a picture of a Dell PowerEdge 720. HP makes the same kind of box as IBM makes the same as well. This has 25 to 26 drive bays in it. I'll say that again to sync that in. 25 to 26 drive bays in it. Assuming you're using
one. And it's like
one,
a 2U. So
yeah, 2U server holds up to 768 gigs of RAM. So assuming you're using those 1 terabyte drives we linked to earlier, that's 10 to 15 terabytes of usable mirrored solid state space. Not even RAID 5, mirrored solid space. There are gotchas with using this approach. You really want a machine that has 2 RAID controllers to break up all the load because this is an incredible amount of throughput.
And for redundancy.
So I've got over here on my blog, if you search for PowerEdge R720, I've got benchmarking that we did on a client with one of those, where they built out a 13 terabyte usable system for something like $20,000. Why go with the SAN if you can avoid it? If you can avoid it and stick with these, as much as I used to love handcrafting boxes too, I want it to just work and not worry about Bubba from down the road and how he wired the RAID controller. You know, I want something that's going to be absolutely bulletproof. That's where you just go with this stuff and forget it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of choices in iSCSI that are cost effective, and you can have a, what do we have? 27 terabytes in the garage?
More than that.
I don't know. We have a 42U rack in the garage, and you know, we have
one of those.
Yeah, it doesn't everybody. But you know, we do a lot of testing on that and a lot of work on that. But it's amazing how much, I mean, we have 15,000 RPM drives. We have 7,200 1 terabyte drives. You know, speed wise, 7,200 RPM. So we've got a wide variety of drives, and you can get a bunch of those in different types of iSCSI arrays for reasonable costs.
And that's just for your photo library. What about for the servers?
Yeah. One entire array.
I don't even start me on that, all right? Okay, I need to trim that down. Okay.
All right, question here.
The potential for ETL on the new Hadoop offerings.
Jeremiah.
Everybody points to Jeremiah in the back.
Yes.
There's Hadoop. There's a Hadoop question. Get off Facebook.
Put down the laptop.
Cat pictures. Yes.
It's good to have those kinds of
ETL there. Via Hadoop.
Yeah. If you've ever tried to parallelize SSIS, you probably also enjoy punching yourself. Hadoop makes loading massive quantities of data really easy. A couple of years ago, there was a presentation at the PaaS Summit about the world's largest analysis services cube, which was some tremendous volume of data.
Yahoo.
It was not loaded with SSIS. That was not loaded with BCP. All that data was processed by a 5,000 server Hadoop cluster. Imagine that for a minute. What's the licensing cost on Hadoop? $0.00 per server. Think about that.
5,000 servers.
Somebody still bought that hardware.
$1 million.
But no, it's still definitely interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and that was in the exabyte range, wasn't it? Yeah.
I think a petabyte to exabyte of raw data processed in under an 8-hour window to load a cube.
It's just a lot of data.
Yahoo. It was Yahoo's.
It was Yahoo.
Wow. Hey, dude, brings the house down.
Dun, dun, dun.
Any last questions? We're in the final few minutes of this
panel.
Oh, you
got another behind you.
Sir.
Given the advances in server technology, what would be a good measuring stick for PLE now that these servers are coming with such huge amounts of RAM in them?
You go first.
So
I'm gonna let you duke this out.
I know a lot of things just still keep coming back to wait stats. What is it that my server's waiting on? If it's storage, then can I either tune it with indexes first, because indexes is free, quote unquote, it's just our labor. If not, can I add more memory and make the problem go away? If I'm talking about 10 terabytes of data, I can't add more memory and make it go away, and then I got to start tuning storage. I don't think that there is one bulletproof metric like PLE anymore. It comes down to this decision tree. If storage is the bottleneck, can I tune indexes? Can I add RAM? And finally, can I make storage faster? This is one of the things I like about, not to plug any vendor, but SQL Sentry's latest version of performance analysis. So it lets you pick one week or day or whatever where you can go, this is a normal day for my business, and it'll baseline everything off of that. And then it does that for all metrics, not just a few.
All right, I think Aaron Bertrand's got a 20 for you. 50? Other questions?
Last chance to play Stump the Chump.
A SQL Server is a general purpose relational database management system, right? You can do anything with it. And when you start to see any kind of post that adamantly says always do X or never do Y, except for auto shrink, sorry. you want to be cautious about that recommendation. Don't get me wrong. They have probably seen a really big problem. They've tested something. They've worked on something. But I do find that sometimes when they're so adamantly against or for something, again, with exceptions, you know, they often have blinders on and they're not looking at the big picture and they're not looking at a wider variety of things to really make that assessment. And I get very frustrated because it happens a lot around certain types of indexes and strategies. So there is no one-size-fits-all solution to everything you guys could possibly do, because look at this room. How many of you are doing different things in different ways? Everyone, right?
Mostly incorrectly.
Dark, Mr. Ozone.
Well, I suppose after this week, do some of you guys feel like you have a few things you got to check when you get back home?
Yeah, right? I see a few hands for that.
Right, which is good, right? You've got places to go and things to fix. But my point is, everything is different. And even the solutions you guys are going to choose are going to be different based on, do you have the time and money to architect a new solution? No. Are you going to kill it with iron? Do you have the budget, the hardware? There's different solutions to different problems, and they all have different pros and cons. So I get very frustrated when something is so, don't do this, never do this, always do this. It's pretty rare. Okay. That's why we use it depends, but we almost always tell you what it depends on. So yeah, we try to
I
get
found
you
behind
to
any certainty is some kind of scar.
Or religion, one of the
speaking
two,
of auto shrink.
Speaking of auto shrink, yeah.
Some kind of scar. Let's have a big hand for our panel.
Woo! Thanks, guys.
And have a great closing session over at SQL Intersection, where we're giving away some swag. We're going to play some 64-bit question, and there are SQL questions in the stack.
Ooh.
And thanks for listening to Run As Radio.